All right, we can begin the world to do today, Be'ezrat Hashem. It is Monday morning, the 27th of November, 2017. And I say hello to my faithful students in front of me and to all listening around the world. I want to bring us up today to have a number of comments to make on the past Shiurim. And then I'll go further. And I'm also going to comment on yesterday's Shiur. Simply, I want to clear the deck before next Sunday. But yesterday we raised the question, we were talking about Rabbi Meir, and in the Mishnah he's never mentioned. They refer to him as Acher, Acherim, but they don't mention his name. So we asked what was the source, and we started discussing, and Eli, you were right, it's the Gemara in Horiyot, Daf Yud Gimel Amid Bet.
The end of
the Masechta. Yes, right before the end of the Masechta, the Masechta ends on Yud Dalet Amid Aleph. And the sources, what Professor Rothkopf said yesterday in class, that I can give it to you in a little bit more detail now, that Rabbi Gamliel was upset, he was the Nasi, and yet people gave cover to Rabbi Meir equal to the Nasi. And there was a Rabbi Natan involved, another one who also was on a very, very high level, and Rabbi Natan felt they could learn better than the Nasi. And they were upset when the Nasi insisted that you stand up for me and remain standing, but you only give the other Chachamim less cover to give Stolzkeit to the position of president. So they planned to trap the Nasi because they felt he wasn't Bucky in Masechet Uktzin and in Taharat. So they stayed up all night, someone heard them, their plan, another Talmud, and he felt very bad, Rabbi Yaakov ben Kashi, he felt very bad, the Nasi will be embarrassed. So he sat down next to the Nasi, I believe they're going, I sat down next to the Nasi, and he allowed, I'm saying it in Yiddish, I don't know what language they spoke then, but after yesterday's shiur with the Munkacha talking to the Ribbono Shel Olam in Yiddish, so maybe they were right in Lakewood, I have to speak Yiddish. And they started Vashtekin Masechet Uktzin, and they were Masbir, and Rabbi Gamliel saw there's something fishy going on. So he asked this individual, why are you learning Uktzin aloud? He told him what's going to happen. So Rabbi Gamliel went over the Masechet, learned it, and the next day he gave shir on it, and then he threw out Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Natan. And then the Talmidim were upset, without these brilliant minds, how can we continue learning? So they said, okay, we'll let them back into the Beis Medrash, but we're going to punish them. And the punishment was that Rabbi Meir is not mentioned in the Mishnah, he's called Acherim, and Rabbi Natan is called Yeshomrim. I also want to mention in relation to, I spoke at the end of the shiur about Chaim Potat and his family with the article, so I mentioned the two brothers, Chaim and Simon. What I didn't mention, there was a younger sister. And the younger sister is married to a Gadol B'Yisrael, whom all of you know, Rabbi Tzvi Sobolovsky. You know who I'm talking about? From, what's he live in, Teaneck, Adam Gadol. First-rate Talmud Chacham. And that's the youngest sibling of the Potak family. So, who told me afterwards? Oh, Michael Miller said to me, he will check out, he says that interview in the paper was he knows the family, they're from Philadelphia. He said the interview in the paper was with the one child who was always rebellious. So he doesn't want to judge the family from that one child. He wants to check maybe there are other children of Chaim who remain from. But very interesting what happens at the end of three generations. And you have a novel here. Just as Chaim Potak wrote a novel, anyone here who's energetic could write a novel on a family in America, Rishon Rebbe's on Einikel, Bels HaChassid, and Vesvet with the Kinder, the Einiklach, the Yur Einiklach. Now, I also want to mention, I can't give it away, I'm in the middle of it, but the latest Jewish action, I couldn't believe it, last night, I always read, when Rav Gerstenfeld died, it's a generation beyond you, Rav Shmuel Gerstenfeld was the only Ungarische Rebbe in YU. I don't want to overstate the case, but believe me, some of my Litvisha Rebbeim didn't relate to him b'kavod. You understand what I'm saying? The Litvisha, I saw so much machleket in my life. I think some of you may appreciate that I try never to be negative. The biggest compliment I got on Washington was, Rebbe, you wrote 530 pages and you didn't maledict anyone. People write memoirs and you know what happens. So Rav Gershenfeld, yes, I don't want to repeat the words I would hear. He had a different approach. He was an Ungarische. He was also the only Rebbe in the yeshiva who knew how to pasken. You understand? He had the Beitin in the yeshiva. The RCA Beitin of today evolves from Rav Gerstenfeld to Rav Yosef Weiss to the Rabbinical Council of America. So, how did I get involved with Rav Gerstenfeld? One second, Jewish action. I want to tell you about this. So when he died and they eulogized him in the yeshiva, it wasn't a simple matter because his son was a very prominent reform rabbi, Lo Aleinu, and they were in Washington. They wouldn't let him speak. They would not let him speak at his father's funeral. They told him, you can come, obviously, but you cannot speak. So in the eulogy, they spoke, Rabbi Gerstenfeld had very devoted Talmidim, and they spoke about in his house how he had a pile of books, all different types of books, next to his bed, that he said when he's tired at night and he can't learn anymore, he reads. So from that I learned many years later, I have a pile of books next to my bed. One of them is on Chabad, one of them is on Rav Meir Balaban, who fought with Rav Moshe Soloveitchik in Tachmoni in Warsaw. And the third one is a baseball book given to me by a Talmud. But last night I said I better finish the current material I have. So I took the Jewish action. Believe it or not, they listened to my shiur yesterday. Half the issue is on exploring the power of prayer. And I have to tell you, some of the paragraphs here by Mechanchim is word by word from Rabbi Asher Klein, why prayer is so important, why prayer is so different, why we have to educate. Children should have a geschmackheit in prayer. Beautiful issue. Kol hakavod to the OU. Now, here I told you something I was guessing. Right? I have confirmation I'm right. My Talmud, Ira Vishnitzer in Chicago, and I thank him. Rebbe, thank you, it's always wonderful. Sure, Mark, that's not important. In Sunday Shia, you wondered about the pronunciation that Lichtenstein uses during davening. I can confirm that when he was a student at YU, he used an Ashkenazic pronunciation during davening. He also did his best to pronounce the ayin like a Taimani. So this is what I thought, that the Reb Aaron's children, I remember I said in class, it's the Sunday class, but I said I'm positive that the Reb Aaron's children, those that are here, Davin Habarashvadit, and Yitzi is Habarashkanazit, but you see, even more, the Ayin, he's already living in Israel, did have a bit of an impact on him. The Ayin has to be the Ayin. I just want to mention to you, the topic of today's shiur will probably have to be changed. Don't use what I advertised. Use Rabbi Chaim Hirshenson. I'll give this to you in a minute. You'll see how to spell it. Now, I got to also, Nachum Lam wrote, and here we're dealing already with the whole history of the Yiddish newspapers. And today, the only papers that are really in Yiddish totally are the two factions of Satma, where each one, Reb Arilis and Reb Zalman, each one has their own paper. Unfortunately, what I said yesterday is true, and what I said last week was only being melamed zchut. And what happened in Riverdale with Abi Weiss's shul is shocking. I don't sleep at night. It haunts me. It haunts me not that you have... You're always going to have Mechalalei Shabbos until Yemot HaMashiach. This is the nature of the beast living among the Gentile world. But that Balabatim, the OU, wants to throw the shul out, and there are Balabatim who oppose it. No, this is an open Gemara that the Goyim have a schut. This is the Gemara in Chulin, that Sadi Bet, look at it. The Goyim have a schut that they may commit adult homosexual relations, but they don't write a ketuvah. Lo kotvin alav ketuvah. And here you give a mazel tov, and Nachum Lem gives me a whole. It happened before, and gives me the links. I'm sick from it. All right, let's forget that. If anyone wants it, you can take it later. The one other point I want to make is I thank Josh Schneider. You see, that we're going to come across the name in the Sunday class, Rabbi Sam Turk, a number of times. There were two Rabbis Turk. There was Rabbi Shmuel Turk, Samuel Turk, and Rabbi Seymour Turk. And the one who was very friendly with Rabbi Menashe Klein is Rabbi Dr. Sam Turk. And Rabbi Dr. Sam Turk is an example of how different the world was then. He was a Torah Vadas Musmach, a PhD, a member of the Zionist Organization of America. He marched with the rabbis in Washington in 43. He was rabbi of Kingsbridge Center of Israel in the Bronx. He's the one corresponding with Rabbi Menashe Klein. Professor Bleich, David Bleich, Rabbi Dr. Bleich, a genius of geniuses, mixed up the two. In a footnote, he's quoting Seymour where it should be Sam. He mixed up the two. And now, Seymour is a YU graduate who was very, very close to Reb Shmuel Belkin. He probably was a Talmud of Reb Shmuel Belkin out of the 30s, and he raised a son in yeshiva, Jerry Turk, who was a little older than I am, and Jerry Turk came in Aliyah shortly after we did. His son grew up here, and he's very prominent in the foreign ministry. And that's a different Turk. This is Seymour Turk. The other one is Sam Turk. But they were both very prominent rabbis with very similar names at the same moment in history. Okay. Back here. So what did we see last week? Today we're going to hit a very interesting individual. But I'll harishon. So what did we see last week? The Agudas Rabbanim is functioning. The problems build up. Some they solve, some they never solve. The Mohel problem, that is something that you would never dream about. That imagine Mohalim were constantly postponing a Shabbos bris for Sunday so they could collect the money on the spot. So people ask me after Shir, why can't they come back on Sunday to collect money? You have to know the mentality. If the person is there, Bishas Maisa, all right, you give him a $5 bill, $3, let's say we're talking 1902, 1905 money. But when he comes back Sunday and knocks on the door, the Brit is over, you don't need him. You put a dollar bill in his hand and you tell him goodbye. And these were the Mohalim. And the battle was ongoing. Now, let me continue. By 1908, the Agudas Rabbanim gets involved in a problem which is hard for us to conceive of today. There is one advanced yeshiva in the United States, Yeshivas Reb Tzvi Chanan. Time and again, the Rabbanim of Agudas HaRabbanim, who are the only Rabbanim in the immigrant community, time and again they say, if there's any future for Jews in America, it's Yeshivas Reb Tzvi Chanan. Yeshivas Reb Tzvi Chanan, beginning with 1907, 1908, it builds up. You can check this out in Rabbi Dr. Gilbert Klapperman's book, which precedes mine. He deals with the early history of the yeshiva, ends off in 1915. My work picks up with 1915 on. And Gil's book is very important because the material there is material that, as time marches on, it's lost. And he put it together very, very nicely. He was a doctorate at Bernard Rebel Graduate School. And who are the students at Yeshivas Reb Tzvi Chanan? So, you have basically, it's the dominating element are greenhorns. These are kids who came over from Europe. They can be teenagers, they can be in their early 20s. And these are kids who already got their foundation in Europe. What Vizekin, Gekent Lernin, the way they could learn, no American kid could equal them. An American kid, even if he went to, for the sake of argument, Eitz Chaim Elementary. He went to RJJ Elementary. But the background that a European kid had when all he did was sit in the Beis Medrash, sit in Cheder, and learn, these kids were way advanced. I had a sprinkling of American kids, few and far between. You really don't have the overwhelming Americans until, I would say, the 1960s. Until 1960, the majority of kids were either first-generation Americans, and they were born in Europe, or they came from homes where the language was Yiddish. But here, these greenhorns are not stupid. They look around. It's like someone coming in Aliyah. You're an Olech Hadash. Within 2 years, 3 years, you see what's going on in Israel. You figure out how you can advance. You figure out how you can fit in. This is where Nefesh B'Nefesh plays a great role. It spares the Oleh, the original Agmas Nefesh of the initial adjustment to a different culture, a different mentality, a different lifestyle. When all is said and done, Beit Medrash, Beit Shemesh, has one tremendous disadvantage. Everyone there speaks English. And ultimately, that's not the best way to adjust to Israel. I came to Aliyah, so I went into a Merkaz Kitaba. Within a number of months, I was on Rehov Rav Berlin 18. There were very few Anglos. You didn't hear English on the street. It's not like today when you can walk in Rehavia and not hear a word of Hebrew. Anyone over 21, either you hear English or French. Those are the two languages. We still came in Aliyah, where you heard German in Rehavia, the old Yekes, and you heard a little Yiddish, and you heard Hebrew, but you didn't hear English, you didn't hear French, all right? But you integrate. These students in America started to demand, we want secular studies. We need an education. Midaf machana panasa, we have to make a living. And what's amazing here, and I told you this, and now put it into context, the Balabatim who were supporting the yeshiva were opposed. Their attitude was very different. Their attitude was, we succeeded in America. We don't even speak a proper English, right or wrong, but we're giving money to the yeshiva. We're giving money because we're busy making a living. We want these young men to learn. We are not interested in wasting time on general subjects. We succeeded, they can succeed too. They don't have to waste time in English. It's amazing. The rabbis, on the other hand, and this is what's hard to conceive of today, the rabbanim, on the other hand, many of them were totally in favor of learning, getting a degree, integrating, for one simple reason. These rabbanim were crippled. They saw the children of their balabatim one by one leave Yiddishkeit. The whole conservative movement was built on this generation. Remember, if you have a product to sell, you need someone to buy it. I need not tell you. You come up today, you saw Black Friday. Look at the advertisements, the sales. But the heart of it was modern technology. I didn't even know what they're selling. Computers, schmooters, little things, phones, iPads, this type, that type. I got to ask my children, my grandchildren, what is this? I got to ask great-grandchildren already, what is this, what is that? You see, but there's a market for it. The poor rabbanim were suffering. They couldn't preach in English. They couldn't speak English. You know how frustrating this was. And this was the seminary. The seminary. Oh, what they turned out. Products. Beautiful English. Intelligent. Graduates of Columbia University. Bachelor's degree. See, we take all this for granted. You can't understand what I'm talking about unless you put yourself into the framework of 1900, early 1900s. Solomon Schechter had tremendous success. He gave the world a product. There was a market for it. These kids didn't want to go reform. The Reformed temple was too goyish for them. You understand? I write in Washington, I walked into a Reformed temple, I think it was Temple Tree. I did my research, I give you all the facts there. And I quote my student, David Gleischer. Why do I quote my student? Because whenever I can quote, he wrote a book, and whenever I can quote someone else, it strengthens my position. This way, people, Rakefet, what do you think, he knows it all? But you're quoting your student, David Clark. David Gleischer knows, obviously. So David Gleischer describes how his father just died, in front of a wonderful family, and the survivor went through the hell of the Holocaust. And here they're struggling in the Bronx, Shomer Shabbos people, and his father says, you know, let's go see what the temple is like. And they walk in on Yom Kippur during the break from their shul to see the temple. The temple probably began at 12 noon, so they don't have to take a break. And they walk down. His father says, wow, this is a church. It's like a church in here. So you see, the East European, but the conservative movement was exactly the melting pot. It was ethnic multiplicity and American culture. Yes, we're Jewish. We daven. 80% is in Hebrew, 20% in English. You understand? Men and women sit together, but they don't have an organ yet. This comes later. Only men have aliyah. The whole concept of what happened with women's liberation and feminism, it's not yet born. But the conservative movement, that is the pull. And these Rabbanim understood. And at the 1908 convention, and you can tie it in with Clapman already, they're speaking word by word what I just told you. Of only future Shishis of Tzolchanim. But we have to see to it that they broaden, that the students are happy, that the students can contribute to the American Torah scene. And this begins a process that lingers on for years. Believe it or not, in 1907, 1908, 1909, the students go on strike demanding high school education in the yeshiva. And finally, that's the whole story which we spoke about years ago, which is really worthy of a movie, how it leads to my cousin, Rabbi Dr. Bernard Revel, who Otzkroll is so... I don't forgive them for not giving credit to the first man to turn the Torah soil. You don't like YU today? Fine. Many people don't like YU today. All right? You don't have to love YU. I can understand you have difference of opinion. But Rabbi Revel turned the soil. He was the only act in town. Everything that came afterwards, including Mr. Mendelovich, is an offshoot from Rabbi Revel. And Rabbi Revel had that ability, you see. He was on one hand a Yudapeyeshudav, an Ilui, a photographic memory. On the other hand, he came to America. Rabbi Leventhal took him under his aegis. Rabbi Zivitz, whom we spoke about, became friendly with him. And in America, here, there's Yudapeyesh kids, like Rabbi Belkin's story. Within a few years, he has a master's, first PhD, drops the university, which today is part of the graduate department of University of Pennsylvania. First PhD from Dropsy is Bernard Revel. And he was in the oil business. We spoke about it. The Shidduch, Sam Travis's daughter, Chaya Sara, he didn't lack for anything. He was in Tulsa, Oklahoma. They built an Orthodox shul there. He went to the oil fields, came home by 12. He couldn't work. He had to start work there at 4 in the morning before the sun came up. By the middle of the day, you couldn't work. He came home, took a nap, and he learned for hours, wrote Chidushei Torah. And they pleaded with him to come to New York and organize the high school. And this was the miracle, but took time. It took strikes and fighting and infighting and the balabatim and the rabbanim. And this is the nature of life. It never goes easily, particularly when you want to innovate and do something new, big, historic. What else is interesting, and here in Israel, Baruch Hashem, we've achieved this, but already at 1900 at this convention, they take on another cause, not just Yeshivas Reb Tzolchanim. They take on the cause of Beth Israel Hospital. Beth Israel Hospital, which was the Lower East Side of New York, was organized to function as a Shomer Shabbos hospital. Kosher, Shomer Shabbos, Jews could eat there from Jews, that was their clientele. And the Rabbanim said, we have to support Beth Israel because this hospital caters willingly and with joy to our population. And here, of course, you know the background. Wherever you go across America, you'll find tremendous Jewish hospitals, Sinai, all over Long Island, Jewish. You can name them one by one in every community where Jews were. Essentially, these hospitals were organized by Reformed Jews. These hospitals weren't even kosher. Just think for a minute. The stories are legendary, people smuggling kosher food in for their family. These hospitals weren't even kosher. They were Jewish hospitals supported by Jewish money. But this was Reform already. Here, Beth Israel was kosher. And they accommodated the Jewish patient who was a servant. On the east side of New York, I was there. I'll tell you when I was there. I was not a patient, Baruch Hashem. I had a very close friend. He should live me well. He's no youngster today. A very famous medical doctor. Dr. Bernard Kabakow, if anyone has heard the name. He was a great cancer specialist. I spent the Shabbos, many a Shabbat in his home, and his phone is ringing all the time. They're calling from all over about, with the chemotherapy, how to balance it out. He was a great, great expert. And when he was active, he should live and be well. Wonderful, wonderful individual. We bonded together over Russian Jewry. He had family there, and I was active. Shvut Ami actually began in his home on the Upper East Side. So Bernie once said to me, do you want to see the Lubavitcher Rebbe? I'm probably the only person in Israel who has this schut, or can boast, I don't know how to put it. The Rebbe, I said, the Rebbe's dying. He said, come. And he in Beth Israel, I met him at Beth Israel, and the top floor was cordoned off. There were two police there, and that's where the Rebbe was. And I went up, you know, he walked up with me, and on the side where his gabayim was, they took turns. They were there, each one an 8-hour shift. They were there 24 hours. We were there, Label Groner was there. And there was Sidurim, there was Sfarim. And the Rebbe was hooked up, Lo Aleinu. I told you, they kept the Rebbe alive purposely. Remember what I told you? And this is a fact. Again, it should be researched today. But my students, the police got in touch with every Orthodox psychiatrist and psychologist that they could locate, identify. And they held sessions what to do when the Rebbe dies. And they were frightened stiff that there would be mass suicides. And because they kept the Rebbe alive, it sunk in he's going to die. So what happened, they did go crazy, but there wasn't suicide, you know what there was? The messianicism. People were drinking l'chaim the night the Rebbe died, drinking l'chaim that his neshama is not going up and he's going to have more power and more influence. I mean, what we suffer from today began then, but at least there were no mass suicides. And that's when I saw Beth Israel Hospital, and today it's a modern hospital. I think they're associated with Mount Sinai. Am I right or wrong? Is it still totally kosher? They have today, you order kosher. I don't know the way it works today. But it was totally a hospital that we have, Baruch Hashem, in Israel. Every hospital is kosher, and we have hospitals that go out of their way to be shown with Torah mitzvot, with every type of patent developed, where they write on Shabbos on slates that you can erase. I mean, it's unbelievable what they've come up with in Shaarei Tzedek, in Ma'ane HaYeshua. But every hospital makes an attempt to accommodate the Jew who cares about Kashrut and Shabbat, which is infinitely higher. Now, the problem of Chinuch haunts them.
What does this have to do with anything?
Oh, the Agudas Rabbanim came out that we Rabbanim have an obligation to support Beth Israel Hospital. You understand, in addition to Yeshivas of Eschol Chanan, you see already they're integrated on the American scene. They know what's going on. the yeshiva is one great object that we have to support, but the other concept is the hospital. Baruch Hashem, we have a kosher hospital. It caters to our people.
That means that the Agudas of Rabbanim of the 1908 is not the Agudas of Rabbanim today.
Forget about the Agudas of Rabbanim of today. Put yourself back in 1908. The Agudas of Rabbanim of 1908 resembles the RCA of today, not what's left of the... We'll come to it. But this is a live, dynamic organization. The Chinuch tortures them. They can't come up with a proper solution. Now, what do I mean they can't come up with a proper solution? I just want to check when I reach... No, so it's Rabbi Hirschhorn here. Okay. They can't come up with a proper solution. What do I mean they can't come up with a proper solution? Because on one hand, what language are you going to teach? Yiddish. The children, even if they speak Yiddish, associate Yiddish with greenhorns. Many of these children were embarrassed if their parents spoke Yiddish in public. You've heard these stories. It's real. It happened. To teach in English, the Rabbanim hat nicht kein Tam. They were hesitant. It's like Rav David Lifshitz used to say, Red a Yiddish sprach, nicht a Goyish sprach. Speak a Jewish language, not a Gentile language. And what he meant was, speak Yiddish, speak Hebrew. But to learn Gemara in English, and Rav David Lifshitz is much later, we're talking now the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, is a much later period. But this, what language? So you should know, the Agudat HaRabbanim tribe spoke about, let us teach in Hebrew. And I have to tell you, when I started Yeshiva Salanta, my classes were in Hebrew, not in Yiddish. The Agudas HaRabbanim felt, at least in Hebrew, it's something different. The kids will not feel second rate, will not feel that they're greenhorns. And they're learning a language which is a key to understanding Tanakh, understanding Mishnah. Once you major Tanakh and you major Mishnah, all right, Gemara is a little bit harder. It's in Aramaic, but if you know Hebrew, you can handle Gemara. I see with my grandchildren, I always wondered, how my grandchildren will master Gemara. They're growing up in Hebrew. I have to tell you, I don't know. There was no problem whatsoever. They mastered Gemara, they were Yeshiva HaKotel, Har Etzion, every Hezdi Yeshiva, I wound up having a grandchild or two. And they mastered very quickly. So this was on the agenda. And here I want to come to a very interesting person, Rabbi Chaim Hirschenson, Hirschenson. A name that has been revitalized today by Chovevei Torah. And let me tell you about him. And he played a big role in this whole drive to educate and to introduce Hebrew. You have to give him credit. Who is Rabbi Chaim Hirschhorn? To look at him, you see a Rav mit a lang gebart, mit peyes, with a rebbeshe, big yarmulke, with lange begodim, I better speak English, I'll get questioned, the younger people here will have a problem, with long clothes, you know, you think this is a typical rav from the old generation. He was and he wasn't. His years, 1857-1935. He was born in Tzfat. His father had emigrated from Eastern Europe in 1848. In 1864, the family moved to Yerushalayim. His older brother, Rabbi Yitzchak Hirschhorn, was very caught up with the dream of reestablishing a Jewish state and speaking Hebrew. His brother was very close to Eliezer ben Yehuda. And you got to understand, Eliezer ben Yehuda dressed like a tzaddik, lived in the Meir Sharim area, lived with the Jews of the Yishuv Hayashan, probably was in the old city first, then they come out, and his wife were a shaper. And all that, they say, he really was not perhaps that religious, but he did it to be accepted, and he would only speak Hebrew. He wanted others to only speak Hebrew. And I have to tell you, God rewarded him. He left a big family here, and on the third or fourth generation from his family, a lot of Balei Tshuva. Mamish 100% in the camp of Torah and Mitzvah. So don't dismiss what he accomplished, what he did so easily. Now, Rabbi Chaim Hirshenhorn was caught up with the Yerushalayim crowd.
Hirshenhorn or
Hirshenson? Hirshenson. The reason I'm saying Hirshenhorn because I had a Talmud Hirshenhorn. Hirshenson. I only had one Talmud who began Hirshenson. Correct me every time. He was caught up with Yerushalayim. He was raised in the Yishuv HaYashan. But as I said, the influence of Eliezer ben Yehuda, modernity, was part of his gestalt as well. In 1904, he's hired as the chief rabbi of Hoboken, New Jersey. Now, I quote from the contract that included Hoboken, West Hoboken, Jersey City Heights, Union Hill, and the environs. Now, what this means was, this was like the Rav coming to Boston. You didn't have one shul. You were the Rav of the entire community. Generally speaking, they referred to Rabbi Hirshenson as the rabbi of Jersey City, because Jersey City evidently was bigger than all the other communities where he was involved. He Americanized, and he was a perfect example of, I'll give you an example today, Rabbi Meir Yaakov Soloveitchik, Spanish Portuguese Synagogue. In my humble opinion, having heard Rabbi Meir Yaakov speak a number of times and have read quite a few of his publications, he and Rabbi Chaim Hirshenson would be a fabulous chavruta. When you hear Rabbi Soloveitchik speak, he's the grandson of Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, the son of Rabbi Leo Soloveitchik from Landa College. When you hear the rabbi of Spanish Portuguese Synagogue speak, anyone who's a great Zionist will be very upset, because there's no one happier to be an American, part of the American civilization, the American culture, Thanksgiving Day, and all that goes with it. And you see, he interviews very famous Americans and they dialogue. This is Rabbi Soloveitchik. This is exactly Rabbi Hirshenson. He was a tremendous mechadesh in halacha, in machshava, published in every rabbinic journal. His best-known work is a six-volume collection of Malki Bakodesh, which dealt with halacha, dealt with the future Jewish state. He was constantly dreaming, how would you run a state? And this came up right now. They tell me in Friday's editorial in the Jerusalem Post, they spoke about abolishing Shabbos. You cannot have a Shabbos if you want to run a modern state. The halacha was written in the Gola, and we have to write a new halacha which would enable a state to run and have planes fly during the week and trains run during the week. And we have Shabbos, the day of preparation and repair and construction and all that goes with it. This is why I don't read the Jerusalem Post. To read it in English, people who should be more intelligent, burns me up. When I read it in Yediyat Achronot, I'm reading it in a foreign language to me. I'm reading it in Hebrew. All right. sondern sein gesund. Idiots, I'm a yoritz, buas, einu yurechet, I'm a litvak. I have to bite my tongue not to maledict them and have mercy on them. And then Lubavitch has to pick me up. And as someone said to the Rebbe, he doesn't know much about Yiddishkeit, he has no yichis. And the Rebbe slapped his face and said, he's a Jew, he's been a Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And if he doesn't know, it's your responsibility to teach him. So Lubavitch smacks my face. I don't go out and teach them, but at least I don't maledict them. Rabbi Hirschenhorn, it was amazing. The problems he dealt with. Democracy. Who else ever dealt with democracy? The whole concept of one person, one vote. Think about it. Why should one person have one vote? I studied when I went into the army, so they interview you. So the lady, the little chayelet says to me, how many years did you study? I started making a cheshbon, 8, 6, this, that. I reached 24 years. She looked at me. What kind of moron? What kind of donkey is this? 24 years, he never graduated? What, are you the stupidest kid alive? You understand? I studied 24 years. I deserve 2 votes. You follow me, Charlie? The street cleaner has 1 vote. I mean, these are unbelievable concepts. Democracy. Do Jews really believe in democracy? Is democracy part of the divine system, the halachic system? Think about it. Shiva Tuvei Ha'ir. Vadar Bar Ratzot. All right, I have to be honest with you. Before I went to Russia, before the Mossad got me involved, I really didn't believe in democracy. After seeing what communist Russia was like, I came back. I had a klap al chet with all the faults of democracy. And de Tocqueville, you know, is excellent, I have to say. If you read Alexis de Tocqueville, the French social scientist, visited America before the Civil War. I think it's 2 volumes he wrote on democracy. When I came back, I said, with all the problems in democracy, no system works better. Ad biyat mashiach, said Cato. But Rav Hirschen said, no one recognizes who I'm talking about. In 1 minute you're going to recognize. He also, feminism, he had, I don't know how many children he had in total, but his most brilliant children were his 3 daughters. Each one was more brilliant than the other. And he, one of the early people to deal with feminism. And I have to tell you, feminism is a tremendous problem that haunts us until this very moment. A woman, I have students, female, I taught 30 years, I taught women. I have, one of my doctors is my Talmid. She was in the last class I taught in Michala, 84-85, the last class, 85-86, I was on leave without pay. In 86, I was able to take advantage of the miracle of anyone. There were no people coming to Israel. The country was in a tremendous depression, and the government announced any teacher who's 50 or older with 10 years of teaching, if he retires, we'll give him this and give him that. And boy, I was like a starving man dying to take it. There were problems in Michal. There were reasons I got out. A year later, the place exploded. But I got out of Mensch, and I was 49, so I didn't know what to do. I went to Masrata Chinuch, and I had befriended a lady there in 1969. I still remember her name, and I said, what do I do? She said, well, you need 1 more year. You better pray all year that the situation remains bad and will continue. And all year I prayed, V'tein talumata l'klala al p'nei ha'adama. And 1 year later, boy, oh boy, you don't understand what I'm saying. I can buy coffee and cake. I made more money not teaching than I ever made teaching. So then I asked the question, where do you get all the money to pay when you're trying to cut down on it? Then they explained to me the secret. The pension fund is separate from the operating fund. So the pension fund has billions of dollars in it. Nothing to do with the operating fund. They can't touch it. But if you retire, you get from the pension fund. Then, you know, I don't have to tell you the statistics, the way it works with insurance and pension funds. A Malik Tiftai and Dred, they got your money. You don't get a penny. But if you beat the system and you're alive and kicking and smiling and teaching and writing and being Machadesh, they lost. And you, Baruch Hashem, the Rebbeinu Shel Olam has been kind to you. So this is a real problem. A girl says to you, Rebbe, I'm your medical doctor. I keep you alive. I can't be a rabbi? I studied medicine. I have every degree in the world. People told me about this doctor. She's the top dermatologist in Jerusalem. She's my student. They tell me her father was a gaon in dermatology in Montreal. Fine. These are real problems. How do you solve them? We live with these. It's ongoing. I don't have to tell you. He was the first one to handle it halachically, hashkafically, philosophically. Now, let me talk a little bit about his daughters and move sideways now. You get a feel of this man, and he was one of the dominant figures in the Agudas HaRabbanim. Oh, you understand what I'm saying? Today they would have thrown him out. Oh, you're not Bikiris, Chaybeveitirinik, Teirumada, you understand? But we're talking 1910. Gentlemen, I mentioned the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue. The Spanish-Portuguese synagogue is the oldest synagogue in the world that's continuous. I don't know of any other synagogue which still is filled, not with 50 people, hundreds and hundreds, the following that they have. And it began revolutionary times, Orthodox synagogue, wow, and they will never change. That orthodoxy is part of their very heritage. At one point, many of their members were Mechallelei Shabbos, but the shul had to have a mechitza. Today, it's a different America, a different New York. So they certainly have the balcony, and just the way it was 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, this is Spanish-Portuguese. One of their most famous rabbis was Rabbi David de Sola Poole. Everyone heard the name. Very prominent Orthodox rabbi, taught at Yeshiva College. You know who his wife was? Tamar Hershon's son. He was married to one of the daughters. And she was the least of a public personage. She was a tzaddeket and a frum and chesed and a rebbetzin in the full sense of the word. But then he had another daughter, Tehila. Listen to the names. Tamar, Tehila. Tehila was married to Rabbi Morris Lichtenstein. Anyone recognize the name? Morris Lichtenstein? What are you saying? Anyone recognize the name Morris Lichtenstein? He was the founder of the Society for Jewish Science. But wait a minute, do you know what the Society for Jewish Science was? There was a Society for Christian Science. And the Society for Jewish Science was based upon their concepts. Jewish science views God as an energy or force penetrating the reality of the universe. God is the source of all reality and not separate from but part of the world, and right thinking has a healing effect. They took God and they removed him from the heavens. There was no longer a concept of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and right and wrong and cheshbon nefesh and matan Torah. To a certain degree, it resembles Mordechai Kaplan's Judaism as a civilization. But here there was a stress on science, right thinking, divine healing. Do you know that the Christian scientists didn't allow you to go to a doctor? Isn't that the Ramban that Reb Chaim said, that Kenish scientist Ramban is impossible, it has to be a toyet sofa where the Ramban says that it's better to pray and not to go to a doctor, that going to a doctor is a compromise. And this was Christian Science, not allowed to go for a doctor. The Jewish scientists were more makil, that they allowed you to go to a doctor and take medicine, but proper thinking. Now, there may be some truth to this. Proper thinking, positivism, divine healing, that was the name of the book that Lichtenstein wrote. You should know that the healer was the first rabbi, female rabbi, in the history of our people that I know of. When her husband died, she became the teacher, preacher, leader of the Jewish scientist movement. I don't know what exists today. I believe there is a little branch left in New York and a little branch in Los Angeles. But at one time, this was a movement. So this is a second order. You start to see Rabbi Hirschman's son and the influence of Jerusalem and Jersey City. You see the conflict, the openness. His daughter marries a Sfadik Rav, a Rebbetzin. Another daughter, she's a rabbi herself with a religion that perhaps has Jewish roots, but is very different from Torah Tashem.
So she wasn't from anything like that.
She was what?
Was she from Orthodox?
In her own practice, I believe she was Shomeret Shabbat. I mean, that was proper thinking, but it's a total different approach than why we're Shomrei Shabbos. It's more or less like, I told you, Mordechai Kaplan showing me his fringes and saying to me that he wears fringes. You understand? Civilization, fringes.
He wore them because it was one of the instruments for keeping the people together.
Right, right.
Not because it's, Hashem
says so. Right. That you're telling me what he wrote. This was Judaism as a civilization. But let me go one step further. And now I come to the one daughter I personally met. And she was very special. And anyone a little bit younger than I am will remember that she made the New York Times in the early 70s. Story, fact. We had a president of the United States. I'll give you her name in a minute. Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon, if you remember properly, Arya, he got involved in Watergate. Okay? They call it BBgate today. That's what the Haaretz named it. He got involved in Watergate. To run away from his tsaris right at the height of the controversy after the Yom Kippur War, he came to visit Israel. President of the United States. I think he might have been the first president who visited Israel. Well, when the president of the United States comes, they take over the King David Hotel. That's the first place. They take many hotels, but that hotel they take over entirely. This year, my good friend Irwin Shapiro was there when President Obama came. What was it? Trump already. Trump came. I've suffered with all of them because I can't get out of my street. And Irwin needs a refuah shleima. He's in a wheelchair. And he has gone to the King David from time immemorial. And he pleaded with them, let me remain in the hotel. And security, United States, said, out. And wheelchair and all had to be moved out, moved on, all that goes with it. When Nixon came, one person was allowed to remain in the King David Hotel. Her name, Nima, N-I-M-A, Adlerblum, A-D-L-E-R-B-L-U-M. Nina Adlerbaum, born in Jerusalem, came to America with her parents. She was about 11 years old, and she became a real American genius. Totally from. tremendous follower. She loved Rabbi Leo Young. That was her rabbi. She married very well. Her husband was very successful. And she devoted herself to her studies. Graduating Columbia, PhD, Talmidah Muvhaka of John Dewey, the famous philosopher. And she wrote on Jewish philosophy. If you study Jewish philosophy, you're going to come across her writings, you come across her books, and you will see her point of view. It's not accepted, but her point of view is very, very Taridic and Jewish. Whenever you study Jewish philosophy, what are you told? That the Jews didn't function in a ghetto. Jewish philosophy was out there. You were influenced by the world, by Aristotle, by Plato. Isn't that what the Rev wanted to write his doctorate on? The influence of, I believe it was Aristotle, on Maimonides, but no one at the University of Berlin could handle such a doctorate and guide him. It was beyond them. She claimed that all the great Jewish philosophers functioned totally within a Jewish context, a ghetto context. There was very little influence from the outside world. And she was...
So what name did she write?
Adlerblum. Nima Adlerblum. I have an inscribed copy of one of her works. I got to meet her. I went to the King David Hotel. I forget already what the connection was. Someone set me up with her. She was a magnificent, majestic lady in her 90s already. But you saw this lady represented prestige, class, underlined the word class. That was the third daughter of Rabbi Hirschenhorn. Son, the third daughter. And they were the most famous of all his children. Okay. He was very active on Agudat Rabbanim. That was his home. He fit in, but he was light years ahead of the other rabbis in his general gestalt. And there were elements in his writings that you would find very left-wing by today's standards. But he appreciated the fact that we're going to have a state of Israel, we're going to contend with halachic problems that we never had before, and dealt with the women issue. You see his own daughters, how they turned out. He was a man ahead of his times. And here I'll tell you a personal story. I don't want to mention the name, but it's not a secret, that by far, a personal story that breaks my heart. Years ago already, when they started YUTorah.org, my shirm going on it, so it has to, I don't know how many years, maybe it's 20 years ago. I didn't know the power of the internet. I didn't know how to turn a computer on then. And I picked up many students who never met me, never sat in my classroom, but heard me. Among the students I picked up was one individual who came from a very prominent Lithuanian rabbinic family. And I'm actually related. My grandson is married to his wife is from this very same family. So we're related to that Yiddisha Machatenim Shaf. And he loved the Shayurim. He actually pleaded with me. I had one student record. He gave me a little recorder. It's in the office, special for him, and immediately send it on to him. He couldn't wait till it went up today, Dr. Krauss does a great job. It goes up minutes after the shir is over. And whenever we'd come to Israel, and I'd be in Hollywood, Florida, we would spend time together, and I got to know him well. And his story was very interesting and very sad. He came from a Borough Park home. Parents sent him to Tel's Yeshiva High School. He graduated high school in 67. And from the graduation, he went to the plane to go to Israel, where he joined the Israeli army, went on to become Rav Seren, a major in the army, Mafaked Machakar or more, something that goes with the rank of major, going to the plane. Some of his Rebbeim intel spat at him that he's leaving America to become a Zionist, go into the army. What's going on right now with the demonstrations? It's not alien to you what I'm saying. And other Rebbeim, secretly closet Zionists, kissed him and admired him. So he came to Israel, and then he got out of the army. And, you know, he made the mistake. He gave all these years to the army, so he was behind. He didn't have money. So he and his wife decided to go back to America for 2-3 years, make a little money. Of course, that turned into an endless stay in America. And he did well, and he established the foundation. And when Chovevei Torah got started, they wanted to reprint Rabbi Hirschenhorn's Sfarim, Malki Bakodesh.
Hirschenson's
Malki Bakodesh. I keep on saying Kenny Hirschenhorn was my Talmud. I can't get the name out of my mouth. Reb Chaim Hirschenson's Malki Bakodesh. I want you to know that this individual sponsored the reprinting. And he was furious with the Haredi world. And then he met me, and I calmed him down. I had a big impact on him, that we don't have to be angry with the Haredim. We have to understand in the world in which they function, but we can be just as good as them, and we don't have to be Haredim, even in my opinion, a little better than they are. So we became very close. The story has a sad ending. A very sad ending. He got involved. There's a whole Israeli mafia in the Florida area. And unfortunately, money problems, and I don't want to go further. He's not alive. If you look at Washington, there's an ad in, a sponsorship in, and he's the only one that it says next to his name, OBM. Zal, you can understand what I'm saying. And I haven't recovered until today. I still have the recorder. Whenever I touch it, I think of him, Reuven. Ugh. But that's life. But that's the Malki Bakodesh, and that's why he loved him, because there was a bit of a rebellion, a bit of a different stance than the Haredi world. And he was one of the main people. Rav Hirschen's son, one of the main people who time and again spoke about chinuch and the ability to teach, and you can't use Yiddish anymore, and this is America. He probably mastered English, I'm positive that he did, but he suggested we'll teach in Hebrew, we'll use that as the main language, and supplement it with English. And let me go a step further.
Did he have any influence in Yeshiva Chanan?
No, I never saw his name come up with Yeshiva Shem Tzichol Chanan.
So how did he express his feelings?
No, it's that they go to Sarabanim.
Don't, I understand that.
But he's talking about Talmud Torah day schools on that level. There weren't many day schools yet, but Talmud Torah, Chadorim in America, he had Chadorim after... I yet went to Cheder for 1 year before my mother switched me to Solanta, you follow? So I remember there was a cheder, you went to the Rebbe, to his house, he taught you, didn't teach you, but it was mashahu Yiddish, something Jewish. So he spoke, how much influence he had, you know yourself how many Talmud Torahs taught in Hebrew. On the east side, there was one successful Talmud Torah in Brooklyn, there were few and far between, but he was a figure of trying to mesh together two worlds, Yerushalayim, and the reality of the modern Western world. Yeah, Malki Bakodesh is part of it was republished, and it's in every library. It's a well-known sefer. Anyone who deals with the history of religious Zionism has to deal with Malki Bakodesh. He deals with halacha, with how he was a visionary way before his times. And you see how his daughters turned out. And Nina Adlerblum I remember her talking with me about Rabbi Young. Oh, did she have Derech Eretz for him? And Tamar de Solopul, she wrote books with her husband. She was a co-authoress with her husband. Check it out. Portraits Etched in Stone, I think it's called. And Lichtenstein is the most famous because she literally was the first rabbi in the ever in the Western world.
Let me go. Did she actually take the title rabbi?
Spiritual leader. I don't think she ever took the title rabbi. But she was, for all intents and purposes, the rabbi. She took over the movement. It faded away. I mean, it was Narishkeit. It's just psychologically, it's true. When you're ill, you have to be positive. Half the battle with illness is the psychological state of mind. If a person has the attitude, I'm going to die anyway, then 90% sure you're going to die. If you have the attitude, I'm going to live, there's a 50% chance you'll manage. You follow?
No. It sounds nice, though.
No, it's that's what doctors tell me, researchers, son, that the mental attitude is very important. Okay, but let me go further. And now I want to show you something else that's amazing. Okay? The other tremendous issue besides Talmud Torah was, of course, the Shabbos problem. And the Shabbos problem is insoluble. I said to the Jews here also, from the family of the person I just spoke about, from Reuven's family, they're going back tonight. So we befriended each other. They befriended me. They know I come to Lawrence once a year. They live in Lawrence. They're part of the same family. And we were speaking yesterday evening between Mincha and Maariv about the problem of the railroad and the Shabbos problem, which is a real problem. I don't want to minimize it. It's not that you can say, chaplop, they want to be Mechalo Shabbos. It's a real problem. When do you service the trains? You don't want trains to go off the track, as they say, Pikuach Nefesh, etc. And I told this person that, all these people, father and son, I said, in my humble opinion, we will never solve these problems until Sunday becomes a Sunday in the Western sense in Israel. If we'll have a workday week of 4.5 days, and Friday your afternoon or Friday off, and Shabbos Sunday, then we have solved the problem. Because Shabbos becomes Shabbos, and Sunday's the day you visit, go to the beach, and you work on the trains, work on the planes, do whatever you want on Sunday. That's the day that transportation runs less, because it has to be serviced. Okay, now let's go back 110, 115 years. The problem of Shabbos haunts the Agudas Rabbanim. At one of their conventions during this period, they have a guest speaker. Who is the guest speaker? The president of JTS and Dropsy, Dr. Cyrus Adler. Dr. Cyrus Adler. What's interesting here, when they write about him, they speak about Professor Adler, Madrupsi College, Philadelphia. They don't mention a word that he's also at JTS. You follow? That's already Artscroll censorship. They're working the way Artscroll would work many years later. And Artscroll is proud of it. You should know that with the death of, what was it, Rabbi Sherman, there were many interviews with the people in Artscroll, and they say in our books about history, we write only what we want our students, our readers to know. We don't have to say all the facts. We can alter them a little. We want to leave a positive message, not a negative message. End quote. Who died? Zlatowitz. So Rav Shlomo Richet Yomim Tovim. They say it's the school of Harichat Yomim if someone says you're gone. You follow? So I want to say a school of Harichat Yomim Tovim, which it is. So here they leave out. But could you imagine? They bring Dr. Adler. He was a Semitic scholar. They bring him to speak at the convention about Shabbos. Now, a little bit background about Cyrus Adler. He was from Germany. He was 100% from. And this is a period where the seminary has many faculty members who are 100% from. This is going to go on into modern times, contemporary times. Even today, there are a few members of the seminary faculty who are 100% from. But they were caught up with the American dream, particularly the 1910s, the 1920s, the 1930s. No one would believe that it would reach a day that the seminary faculty is ordaining women and ordaining lesbians and gays, etc., etc. This was beyond wildest comprehension. Yes, we may make a compromise or two with the Americans. It's what I spoke about yesterday in class with Marcus Jastrow and Henry and Benjamin Zold, Rabbis Jastrow and Rabbi Zold. It's the same concept. So he came to speak, and the convention topic was on Shabbos. And he said exactly what I said last night. We're never going to solve the problem of Shabbos until we have a five-day week in America. And he called upon the Rabbanim to pressure their congressmen, any politicians they have contact with, that we must have a five-day week. And Professor Adler told them their factories that switched to a five-day week. And they just add on an extra half hour, an extra hour during the week, and they accomplish as much in 5 days as they would in 6 days. And he pleads with the rabbis, and I have to tell you, this was the ultimate achievement of America, that Baruch Hashem, today we have a five-day week. I grew up where everyone worked on Shabbos. It was a given. It was half a day work. You didn't work all day. Half a day work. Today, in all the states where Jews live in large numbers, they're even protected that they have the right to leave early on Friday to get home before Shabbos. They have to make it up during the week, so you work an extra hour here, an extra hour there, but they're totally protected. Halavai, we should have a five-day week in Israel. When we came in Aliyah, we used to say there are two Mondays in the week. There's no Sunday. Got it? Monday, Monday, then Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. No Sunday. Now I'm living in Israel so long, I'm shocked when I travel outside of Israel and I see there's a Sunday. It's beyond my comprehension. And people have minyanim and shtivlach. All week they daven 6:30 and Sunday they daven 7:30. Mamish, they're worshiping. That's the Gemara. Kol hadah b'chutz laretz ke'ilu oved avodah zarah. It's the Gemara at the end of avodah zarah. I have a Hasidish Talmud friend who once said to me, my grandson called me and he says, Zayda, what are you doing in Chutz Laretz? You're Oved Avodah Zarah. And the Zayda answers him, my entire anacle, my dear grandson, you're missing one word, Ki'ilu, as if, but not totally. But you see, this issue, and Professor Cyrus Atlas speaks, a good as Harabanim, and gives a beautiful solution, which ultimately comes about. But it doesn't come about until the 50s, the 60s. It's not going to be achieved.
When was Sunday made off as a day off?
First of all, it's not that it's made off. It goes from state to state, business. But it really, the dominoes started falling after World War II. After World War II, there was a tremendous resurge in the economy, right or wrong, and America dominates the world, and they can afford already to have a five-day week. And it begins slowly but surely. Then the federal government, once the federal government has a five-day week, it comes to be, and we benefit from it. Baruch Hashem, it helps us in our religious existence. Then another problem comes up, and it's amazing. This problem has not left us until today. And amazing, here's the Agudas HaRabbanim dealing with in 1910. Okay, and this you have to remember: the Palestine is reawakening. We're going to come to this very big with World War I. The whole picture and gestalt and the heart of the Jewish world changes dramatically. All eyes from that moment on center on Eretz Yisrael. There are reasons why. We'll get to it. But right now, 1910, the Zionist movement has now been around. People are coming in Aliyah since the 1980s, coming in Aliyah. But these are the people coming to work the land. What we can't overlook is that there always was Jews living in Eretz Yisrael. Now, who says it clearly? The Rambam, the Maimonides and Sefer Mitzvot. The whole concept of Kiddush HaChodesh is built upon the fact that there's a minion of Jews in Eretz Yisrael. The Rav gave endless shayurim on this, but the whole the Rambam says that if you could envision a time when there'll be no Jews in Israel, the Jewish calendar will cease to exist. But God promised us shelo yidach mimenu nidach. So there were always Jews coming to Eretz Yisrael, but these Jews came to die here. They didn't come to work here. They came to daven. They prayed for you. The whole concept was during the Golan, we're praying for you at the Kosel HaMaravi, at the Wailing Wall, and you have to support us. This is the Kupat Rabbeinu Meir Bar Hanes, that every pious woman before she lit candles threw money into a pushka for the Jews in Eretz Yisrael. No, what was this called? Books have been written about this. Avram Yari, Chalukah. That's the key word. Chalukah. Oh boy. When you get involved in Chalukah, how much machloikid is there? Just think for a moment. Batei Vasha, Batei Ungarin. These were all areas built by money coming from that location. Imagine you come in and marry someone and they say, you are Litvak, you're not entitled. The machlokes is endless. Money, who handles money? How many scandals do we have of people handling money? I don't have to elaborate. A student of mine just was sentenced, I think, to 3 years, 5 years in jail, if he pays up and endless millions that he... you all read about it. It made every newspaper, the Far Rockaway area, handling a charity fund. Oh my gosh. All right, he had to marry off children. I know a story here. Again, part of the Ruvain's family, a very famous Rosh Yeshiva. He meets... you don't know what I've been through in life. Had a Talmud in BMT from South Africa. So he comes back the summer, South Africa, and he says to me, Rebbe, this rabbi, this Rosh Yeshiva, he gives me the name from, no, that's my name, this Rosh Yeshiva from Israel visited, and I got to be friendly with him, and he says to me, I don't want to die until I have $1 million in my pocket. That's the Rosh Yeshiva's message. So I say to this young man, I say, I'll tell you the name of that Rosh Yeshiva. I gave him the name. He almost fainted. He said, how did you know? How did you know? I said, Baruch Hashem. I know. I live in Israel long enough to know who it is. But people, and then he got ill, and he had $1 million. This is, it was headlines here. In 1990s, Ari Derry was involved before he was. He had $1 million. His gabbai robbed it. He had to marry off three children, and with $1 million, he bought three apartments. Baruch Hashem. You don't know what went on here. And got so. So you see, with Chalukah, they started yelling and shouting that it's phony, it's a farce. You shouldn't contribute. The money's misused. It's misappropriated. Miscreant behavior. Everything that went on all over the world. This voice, you hear this until today, the Chalukah, the stormtroopers are going to jail, how much money they're going to get every day they're in jail. Satmar's holding a big campaign, people are giving thousands and thousands. Will they get it? Won't they get it? You understand, there's always gossip. The Agudas HaRabbanim appointed a committee. And the committee investigated the Chalukah. And the committee can testify that Gedolei Yisrael, Tzaddikim, people who are 100% reliable, the money that reaches Israel, I can quote word by word what they're saying here, Ki HaKesef HaMegia L'Eretz Yisrael, M'chaleket B'Seda U'B'Yosha, it's given out properly, and it's given out with principle it's given out in a way that we all can be proud of. And chas v'chalila to continue to murmur, to spread evil about the chalukah. And then they go on. We absolutely have to support the Jews living in the holy cities in Palestine. Yerushalayim, Hebron, Tzvat, Tveria, the Agudas Rabbanim has to take the lead in supporting these people. And you see the love of Eretz Yisrael, and you see the attempt to combat the viciousness, Chalukah. Now, I have to tell you, there's probably some truth. Whenever people touch money, there's always the chance, the temptation. If you know my own personal practice, I do not touch money. People call me, can we buy your books? I tell them you have to go online, I go to the publisher, go here, go there. I don't sell my own books, I don't touch money on principle. There's a Chabadnik, I want to give a gift to one of my books now, someone I've heard teach, I'm very impressed. But there is truth. But overall, you take, for example, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, all right? Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, people gave him, over the years, tens and tens of millions of dollars. He had a Gabbait Stucker. The Gabbait Stucker gave out the money. He didn't touch it. Did you ever see where Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach lived? I used to walk past his house at least once, twice a week. Now they rebuilt it. You can't believe the conditions. And he was the happiest person alive. These were tzaddikim, yesod olam. You know who his Gabbait Stucker was? No? Who's the famous YU Rosh Yeshiva who gives shayurim all over and will be on it at the Hanukkah dinner? Rabbi Goldwick's father. Meir Goldwick's father was the Gabbait Stucker. His father was the brother of the Rosh Yeshiva of Kerem Biavna. One became a great Rosh Yeshiva, and one was the Gabbait Stucker of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. So, I mean, you have to understand who we're talking about. It's unfair. And I can't say to you there was never a miscreant act. I know what life is about. I would be very naive to say that. But by and large, the money, 100%. I yet saw Rabbi Levine. I yet saw met Rabbi Levine 1968. He died. He died, I think, early 69 or late 69. He was still walking. I met him and I saw where he lived, right near Machne Yehuda. And right near not Nachalot of today. Today that area is the center of the world. I don't have to tell you what's going on there. Like my wife says, imagine that we bought some property and we could have bought it for nothing. Of course, I had no money then, but you could have bought it for next to nothing. But that's worse today. But these people with tzaddikim, this was the Yishuv HaYashin. This was Reb Yitzchak Blaser, Reb Naftali Amshtadam. People came from all. They didn't come to work. They didn't come to change the world. They came their final years, many. Others raised families here, children, chalukah, but not to be negative. And they played a big role. You know, when all is said and done, their children, the state was built by their children. Unfortunately, not many of them remain from. The kids growing up in the 40s, the 50s here, I've told you more than once that they were inspired by Zionism, by the dawn of tomorrow. Most of the generals of the IDF until the 70s, 80s, were kids from these homes, from Meir Shearim, from the Yishuv HaYashan, from Petach Tikva. One by one, check it out, the names, the background. Unfortunately, many of them were no longer from. I still remember in the early 70s, I went to, I was in Geula, could be for Rosh Hashanah or Erev Rosh Hashanah, And I see by the Gera Rebbe, by the Gera Shtibel, it was Rebbe Yisrael, it was the previous Rebbe, and I see army cars pulling up and guys coming out and high rank generals. And I said, Mazer? They said, they're coming to the Rebbe for Rosh Hashanah. They're all from a Gera background. And I can tell you, B'didi Havayuvda, my neighbor is, he should have a refuah shleima, he's not that well now, Moshe Mandelbaum, recognize the name, he was candidate for the mayor of Jerusalem. Moshe Mandelbaum, he was, what do they call it, the Bank of Israel, the head person, what's the word they use? What was the word? Governor, how do they say it in Hebrew? What's the word in the Brit? Nagid, right, Nagid Bank Yisrael. So he was the mankal, the manahel klali of the office of Barlev. Barlev, when the Mapai was still in power, and he tells me, one time in this building, I can tell you where it's where the Waldorf Astoria Hotel is. That's where the Ministry of Avodah, the Treasury, whatever was there, was in that building. So the building was guarded on all sides, government building. And he's sitting with the, in the anteroom before where the minister sits, and he's the mankal, and there's a knock on the door. Secretary opens the door, and there's a guy with langer begodim, a bod, and payas. And Moshe Mandelbaum says to himself, pardon my French, what the hell is a mishulach doing here? How did he get into the building? And the secretary says to him, he's not here to see you, he's here to see his brother, the Tsar. It was Barlev's brother, you understand? They came from these homes, but the Chalukah, these people, played a tremendous role in what becomes the reality of a Zionist dream. Today, we have to help many of their grandchildren, great-grandchildren, have come back belave the nefesh. But this is the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu works. There's Hashgacha Pratit, there's Hishtatlut, but the Agudas Rabbanim was absolutely right. It's unfair to criticize Chalukah. There was less sinful behavior with Chalukah than there is in general monetary life. Can I put it that way, Dov? You follow me? If you compare, I don't have to give you a who's who who's sitting behind bars in the state of Israel on monetary factors. Anyway, so this is the Agudas Rabbanim. There's more to talk about. Next time we meet in this class, we're going to deal with Reb Lazer Silva, who becomes a young man, who becomes a prime figure. And we're going to call Reb Lazer Silva. And those of you that still have hair, when you hear the quote, the hair will disappear very quickly. And believe me, Art Scroll would never write up history with that quote. But evidently, when this book was written in the late 20s, they still were honest. But we will get there. And then comes World War I, and then the whole picture of Agudat Yisrael changes. And we have a lot more to do. It's not going to finish this year. Agudat HaRabbanim, the whole picture changes. And America and the responsibility, and the Central Relief Committee. And then you get in with the RCA. By now, 30 years have gone by, and there's a new generation of rabbis, not JTS, but REITs, English-speaking, and the whole relationship, very, very fascinating. So I want to reiterate, so what do we do today? It's a fascinating, we're touching upon topics. I think the heart of the class, the main point are the three daughters of Rabbi Hirschman's son. Those three daughters speak for themselves. And they succeeded, they conquered America and remained, at least two of the three, remained dedicated Jews. I wonder what's left in the world, Adelblum, if there were any other children. She wrote, if you open up Leo Young's books, you'll find articles written by Nima Adelblum.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. Open up, go on. Yeah. The you have them. Take a look and see. I have from the biographer books she's written. Okay. In addition, all right, we touched upon Chalukah. We touched upon Shabbos, Cyrus Adler, Chinuch, Rabbi Hirschman, Rabbi Hirsch's son, Chinuch. These are problems that we struggled with until today. Today, Yiddish is not a factor, but Hebrew, can we teach Hebrew? Do we prefer to teach in English? We want the kids to understand. These are, you know, Ramaz, someone just died, and my wife, when she saw the name, she jumped and said, she said, gee, this kid, if this is him, he grew up in the Bronx on Valentine Avenue where we lived. He was my younger sister's classmate. And I checked, he died in Ramat Beit Shemesh. And I checked it out here with Rabbi David finally. And it's absolutely, that's the person who died. So Rabbi David was telling me, my wife told me, he came from a totally irreligious home, but very well-to-do, succeeded business-wise. And this kid went to Ramaz to avoid public school and perhaps Zionist feeling, but certainly not a Shabbos feeling, not a Kashrut feeling. And this kid, Rabbi David described him as a tzaddik. Could you imagine how he developed in life? Lived in Washington, came in Aliyah from there, and he knew perfect Hebrew. He was a Ramaz graduate in Beit Shemesh. How many Anglos know Hebrew perfectly? He was perfectly at home in Hebrew. Ramaz graduate. I don't think Flatbush, do they still teach totally in Hebrew today? Or has English been... Yes, because there's a problem. You want the kid to be firm. You want the kid to have proper hashkafa. You don't want the kid to be totally Americanized with Western culture. English speaks to his heart. Hebrew is nice, but it's not reaching his inner soul. He counts in English, not in Hebrew. And this, I write about it. This was my ongoing debate with Nechama Leibowitz. She used to be upset with me that I taught BMT in gold. I taught in English. So I told her, Nechama, yesh li rak shana achat letfos hotam. I have 1 year in which to capture them. I have to capture them in their native language. They'll learn Hebrew if they'll come in Aliyah. But right now, I have to inspire them. But I couldn't budge her. She made believe she didn't know a word of English. Ever hear her English? It was better than all three of us, three out of the class put together. With those of us that have PhDs in this class put us all together, and we still don't equal Nechama's English. Gentlemen, I want to state that beginning Sunday, Ani Modeh LaKadosh Baruch Hu, I begin a special series of Hakarat HaTov. Anyone is welcome to take a copy. I don't have any other way to do it. It has to be ongoing. I can't give Sunday one thing, Monday another. I have to express myself ongoing. I'm telling you in advance, I'm not giving the lives of these people. I'm giving you my take on them, my interaction with them, and what they did for your humble servant. You'll understand on Sunday. Give this to Vic, please. Now, if anyone is interested, I needed this for some research, but the truth is I don't have where to keep everything. Dinei Mishpacha, the laws of the land of Israel, how it affects you from the point of view of personal status, the power of the rabbinate. This is from Ben Sion Shereshevsky's work, Zeichat Zichrono Levracha. I knew him personally, and he lived around the corner from me. He was a judge in the Supreme Court of Israel, a first-rate Yekka Talmud Chacham. So this is on the power of the rabbinate when it comes to matters of personal status. If anyone wants a copy, I have a few more left. The Lord's Prayer, which really tests around, it's second to none. You won't believe this, but this really happened. It's in the news all over the world now. Everyone recognized the name Professor Sorkin. Professor Sorkin is the world-class genius who is taking care of Rabbi Steinman. If you look at him, he has the yarmulke on. Here this man is meeting the press of the world. Even the New York Times is interested in Rabbi Steinman, should live and be well. And he wears the yarmulke, Yechi Adonai, the reign of Rabbeinu Melech HaMashiach, Olam Va'ed. The Vishnitzer Rebbe of Mutzik took very ill, and evidently Professor Sorkin's expertise is in the field that he needs him to. So now they're asking him to remain in Bnei Brak where he lives, or go to Muncie where they're offering him a fortune of money. And he didn't know what to do. He took the Igrot Kodesh of the Rebbe and opened it, and he got his answer. Read the article. Remain in Eretz Yisrael. The Rebbe wrote to the letter he, and there's a picture of it here. Do not become involved with Rabbanim abroad. Unbelievable. It really happened. I don't know how they come up with this. If you remember Curly of the Three Stooges, here is his Machsefer. If you remember Bugsy, of course. All of Hollywood was Jewish. Lo aleinu. Bugsy Siegel was Morelich. His daughter just got a Jewish burial. Chabad in Las Vegas. The family said, could you imagine their poor Bugsy Siegel's grandchildren? And they said it's cheaper to cremate the body. And Chabad arranged for full Jewish burial. Here's a very good story, the Rebbe with Tzemach Mendelow. And here, two people come to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe says, don't go to college. And the other one, the Rebbe tells to Mendelow, finish college. You already put in 3 years. Don't waste it. I have to tell you that Rabaron Cutler was in Lakewood. Same story. There was a fellow from YU Deer, very able. And he loved Lakewood like we all did. He loved Rabaron. And he had 3 years in YU. And he went to Rabaron, I want to leave. I want to come to Lakewood. And Vic Rabaron told him, mit ein Jahr kem ratav in draya. Yeah, with one more year, you'll save the 3 years you wasted. Don't come to Lakewood yet. I don't know what happened to him. If anyone knows Deer, I've been racking my head to try to work out his first name. He was such an able a guy.
What's the name?
Deer. He was ahead of me in YU.
It was a deer that came from North Carolina.
Right, that's a different deer. Emil Deer, that's a different family. This is unbelievable. I spoke about it yesterday. If anyone wants it, the Ramah comes to life. A week ago, Shabbos, they were Masada Kedushin, 10 o'clock at night, Saturday night, in Bnei Brak, on Shabbos, Somer Chan Aaron Rakefet's classes under Ramah and his Tshuva. This is already in Yonah B'Yoma, night-long Fabrengin at 7:70, gearing up for the Shluchim Conference. Now, the pictures are very interesting, but I always, this is Chabad Online, I wish they would identify some of the people in the pictures. Here's unbelievable shit. Chabad opens in Uganda. Could you imagine? And it's unbelievable. And the Chabad Shlucha here looks like she stepped out of Vogue magazine. This is a story. Who reads Hebrew well? I'd like your reaction. Aaron, I want you to read this and tell me what you think. I'm not going to tell you what I think. I want to hear what you think. I want to see if I'm off the wall or I think like a Talmud of the Rav. Here, a guy tells a story how he was mashpia on a zug on the airplane in business class on demand to put on tefillin. Guy laughed at him and how he's mashpia. I want your reaction to how he's mashpia. Okay? Take it, and let's see if the black turns white. This is the Shluchim Gala Conference. This is the unbelievable picture of the 5,000 plus Shluchim in front of 770. And I think I've told you, I can say it publicly, there's an ad going around right now, an ad, a pasvailer, call it what you wish. So it has a picture of Rav Shach, and underneath it has Rav Orbach, and says, this is Rav Shach's contribution. Next to it is the Rebbe.
Shmuel Orbach.
And next to it is a picture of the Rebbe and the 5,000 plus Shluchim. And this is the Rebbe's contribution. You understand? Because Rav Shach fought Chabad, so Chabad today is taking, I don't want to say revenge, but they sure are spelling it out very properly. This is a Shaluah Chabad in Utah, and his biggest supporters are the Mormons. It's unbelievable. here, this is the Jerusalem Post takeoff on it, an unlikely friendship, the rabbi among the Mormons.
The Mormons consider us relatives.
No, Baruch Hashem.
They believe that they are the people.
And here's a beautiful story again. And he stood up and began walking, the miracles of the Rebbe. Now I'm going to tell you what happened to me yesterday. And I came home and I don't know. You can't explain it. I said to my good friend Barry Liebman, did the Rebbe have Ruach HaKodesh or not? I read all these stories. And Barry, who's a Gnabar Nechassid, was hesitant to say, Rabbi Steinsaltz said the Rebbe had Ruach HaKodesh. He's the only one that says it black and white. The other biographies do not say it. So yesterday I'm talking with a guy with big Litvashi Yichas. I was referring to him before. So we got involved with Lubavitcher Rebbe. I don't know how. And he tells me to find, this is a guy that you would say never looked at the Rebbe. A Litvak, I know who his family, what they stand for. Real Litvaks, they're upset with their my children's family married into because they're all religious Zionists. They happen to be tzaddikim, but they're Zionists, religious Zionists. So this fella got married late, and he had two children. And his wife can't have any more, it seems. And he's very upset. And someone told him, go to the Rebbe when he hands out dollars. And he left. All right, when you're desperate, shoppen ken das nicht, if you know Yiddish, it can't come. So he goes to the Rebbe, and he says to the Rebbe, he tells the Rebbe, I have two children, but I would like more, and I need a bracha from the Rebbe. My wife should be able to. And the Rebbe counts out $5 and gives him $5 and says, Yivetabmeh. Do you know that he had five more children, one after another? Now, Charlie Ayeka, let me hear. How do you explain it? I don't know. What would Rabbi Schwab say? What would Rabbi Yosef Breuer say? I don't know.
What would the Rav say?
I wish we could ask the Rav.
But you know something? Because in the area of these things, we have to admit, mysterious things do happen.
But the Rebbe? So cynics will say to me, yeah, but there's stories where the Rebbe gave a bracha and it didn't happen. Let me hear the story. And you never hear the story. All right, you hear the story, it's success. But this is... I mean, you can multiply this by many other stories, as you see here.
You told us the story of during World War II, a soldier...
Right.
...to do the deal with
the... Korean War.
And when he came back...
Right.
...everybody in the foxhole...
Right. The Rebbe became famous through this story. It was the early 50s, and Commentary, which was widely read, wrote the story up. And it was very simple. This kid from Brooklyn was being drafted into the army. A kid... You know, a Brooklyn kid, you can't avoid from people in Brooklyn. So some of his friends said to this American kid, look, go to the Rebbe, get a blessing, because you're going to be in great danger. So the kid goes to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe tells him, you tell this kid, be very careful with this mitzvah of Netilat Yadayim. Whenever you're going to eat bread, be Netilat Yadayim. So there he is on the front, and he wants to eat, and there's no water. But he knows if he walks 10 minutes away, they have a central base with water. I remember in the Israeli army when I fought in Lebanon, so behind the frontline troops, there were water trucks. So then his Yetzer Hara says, why do you have to walk 10 minutes? The Rebbe said, wash with water if water's available, but here, no, the Rebbe said he walks, and he comes back, and everyone is gone. How do you explain that? I don't know, katanti, but I would love, in my vision, to see the days that Chassidim and the Mitnagdim and all Torah Jews got along 100%, and we wouldn't be ashamed. We don't have to shudder when we hear the news, the city is shut down. Yesterday, the bridge coming into Yerushalayim was shut down twice. First, the Nechim demonstrated. Then the stormtroopers got there. They first shut down the center of the city. And then the police came on horses. You got to watch the news. The police came and got rid of them. So the horses went away. 2 minutes later, once the horses leave, it shut down again. Then they came with water guns, cannons, and they were dancing like they're in Mitzvah.
With the smell of that came from that. Davening Mincha.
Davening Mincha, I tell you, very... Don't let it depress you, Ellie. It's going to be good. Got to keep the spirit up. Let me end off the class. You all wonder who Professor Rothkopf is. People ask me, related, not related. Story is very simple. He was walking along Brooklyn next to, was it Brooklyn or downtown Manhattan? Downtown Manhattan next to the pier, and he sees a group of Frum kids walking along. So he says to these kids, in 1969, it wasn't so common to see kids with yarmulkes in the streets of Manhattan. He says to the kids, where are you going? So the kids say, we're going to see our Rebbe off. He's sailing for Israel. So he joined them. He figured he'll come along. And that's where we first met. The truth is, Ellie and Leah followed us a month or two later, also by boat, right or wrong?
By plane.
By
707
by plane. So you came to the boat just to see me?
Because of the Shiloh, my son Ari was born in October. And the boat they said would be a little rough sailing. Although you save money when you go by boat, because you can take more stuff.
You can take more stuff. So that's how we first met. And Ellie lived here a few years. He got his PhD from Hebrew U. I'm a little bit upset with him that where he wound up teaching and his stuff. But once I'll hear that the great-grandchildren are coming back, I'll be very, very happy. We'll put it that way. But it's really funny because in the Merkaz Klita we used to get each other's mail. Aleph Rothkopf, Aaron Rothkopf, Eliyahu Rothkopf. One time he went into the bank dealing with his mortgage, and they're giving him all the information until they realize 20 minutes later they're talking about me, Rav Berlin, not where he was buying in Ramat Eshkol. But those are some of the stories before there was a Nefesh B'Nefesh. I want to thank everyone for coming and allowing me to express myself. And Be'ezrat Hashem, the Rebbe Einstein should give us only good news. I have a Brit tomorrow, a Nur Einikel, down the block from here. If you know the shul in Givat Mordechai with the stained glass windows, Eitz Yosef, that's where the Brit is. And it should just be Besorah Tova, the length of Al Kol Yisrael, until we meet again next Sunday, Be'ezrat Hashem, when we shift gears and Hakarat HaTov. Until we meet again in health and happiness. Das Vedanya. Take whatever you wish.